You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of September 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme...
Your doctors or your family ever give you a hard time about your weight?
Yeah, I think I could lose a little weight. I've always been a little bit this way, you know? I've sort of always been that.
Donald Trump releases his health information, finally revealing what maybe some suspected, that he's a little overweight. But do larger leaders fare any worse than fit ones? We'll look at some news from the print industry as Die Zeit launches a new title, Zeit Magazine Man. We'll also discuss how London Fashion Week, which launches today, stays relevant. Plus, we list some of the greatest animal heroes ever known after 100-year-old Diego the Tortoise saves his species on the Galapagos Islands through the means of manic mating. Oh yes, that's all to come on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. What a show we have in store. Very much a Friday afternoon vibe, which is of course, here in London. A whisker after 1800 hours, but a very good evening to you. Good morning, good night, wherever in the world you are. Let me welcome you, also my guests today on Midori House. Some familiar voices from Monocle 24. Henry Rhys Sheridan is here.
Do I say something to signal my presence?
You have just done so. Marco Sippi.
Hello there, good evening.
And Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Hello, everyone.
Welcome, one and all, to the programme. Now, as we're hearing in the menu at the top of the show, the candidate's health has become a major theme on the US presidential campaign trail after Hillary Clinton had to take a break from campaigning due to pneumonia. The Republican nominee, Donald Trump, released his own medical reports this week. According to them, he's in excellent health, but despite having normal cholesterol and blood pressure levels, he is somewhat overweight. He's 190 centimetres, 6 foot 3 inches tall, but he weighs 107 kilos, 236 pounds. A question to you all to start off with. Henry, perhaps I'll come to you first of all. The health or otherwise of the candidates has been front and centre this week, and actually it's kept cropping up during the campaign. Does Donald Trump's weight really matter in the grand scheme of things?
In preparation for this edition of Midori House, I was handed this photocopied article. I believe it's from the Times of London. Mm. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And it's looking at the history of the weight and health of various US presidents. And buried in the middle column of the article, there is an account of William Howard Taft's weight. He tops the list at 24 stone. And there's an important note here. The 27th US president had to install a bigger bathtub in the White House after he became stuck in a smaller one. I think that some kind of line has to be drawn where adjustments to the infrastructure of the White House begin.
Aren't necessary.
For me, that is the, what would you call it, litmus? I don't know. That's a line in the sand. I think if you cross that line, it becomes
an issue, a
public issue.
And just for our other international listeners, William Howard Taft, so 24 stone, 4 pounds, that's 340 pounds in total, which is, I mean, that is weighty. And there's a picture of him here. He's a large guy, and he's got a handlebar moustache.
He's not un-Trumpian in his aesthetic.
No. But Fernando, I mean, there is a serious point here, which is obviously, you know, Hillary's health prompted some pretty extraordinary discussions this week about, you know, what would happen if a candidate, for example, you know, weren't to last through, you know, the remaining months of campaigning. Presumably, if somebody, and both of these people are in their, what, late 60s or early 70s, are going to be leading the free world for the next 4 years or 5 years, as it will turn out being, we need to know that they're up to the task, physically as well as mentally.
I think so, but I do believe the press, especially in this American election, they've been quite invasive in a way. I think, you know, I'm not sure if the public, they care that much about it. And you were asking about Donald Trump's size. I mean, okay, he was a little bit overweight, but to be honest, so is more than half of the American population as well. And so probably this would create a connection with voters. And I have a theory, actually, that I think voters do like their politicians a little bit portly, on the portly side. I mean, we have Churchill, we have Chavez. I have so many examples to give you, you know. I personally don't mind.
I would like to draw some comparisons to the business world over here. I was thinking about how we are seeing in business world nowadays, kind of demands. You feel that business leaders, they feel the pressure that they should keep themselves in good shape. It's kind of, it seems to be this very dominant ideology now that you have to be fit to be a good leader. Quite often, if you look at some of the most successful American leaders in particular, I'm just thinking about how they so often emphasize about how little sleep they do, how much they can work, and how efficient and effective they are. And kind of part of that thing is that they're keeping themselves in an amazingly good shape. So in a way, I'm not saying that weight would necessarily matter, for example, in the case of Donald Trump, but I'm still thinking that in some cases, if you are very fit, that may signal that you actually are going to be able to do more, maybe, than someone else. I'm also wondering if when we saw Justin Trudeau getting to power in Canada, for example, I'm wondering if we would feel the same had he been 40 kilos heavier.
Can I just come back to something that Faye touched upon that I found interesting, which is the fact that, you know, most of the US public are probably closer, or a significant chunk of them are probably closer to Donald Trump's weight than not. Would you go as far as to say that it would be undemocratic for a leader, a political leader, to assume office who deviated from the average weight of the nation in either direction? Is there some kind of weight representation that needs to go on here? We talk about representation in terms of gender, colour, all the time. Do you think that's important?
I think so, especially, you know, for his voters, you know, and even though he's a billionaire and everything, he is the man's man, you know, the guy who's going to represent middle America in a way.
Well, he's still,
and that's another example of that.
He's still the man or the candidate of the two that wins the old who would you want to have a beer with? Worrying.
Exactly.
But I sense from what you said, Fernando, that this was tapping into something a bit different. And that, you know, the more, I don't know what you say, sort of corpulent, the more, the plumper politician, does it, to you, does that speak of someone who knows how to live well? In a way, is that more important than, you know, anything about, it's not really about health and well-being, it's about someone who knows how to enjoy themselves. It shows they'll be able to connect with people.
Absolutely. And you know, and there's a classic example, even in my own country, Brazil, our most popular president ever, Lula. I mean, I wouldn't call him obese. I mean, he was slightly overweight. And he did have this kind of super charismatic image. You know, he was bearded. He probably had a beer belly. And I think people connected with that.
People think there's a warmth to the more heavyset politicians.
But at the same time, you know, what Marco said, I mean, also represents, I think perhaps we are changing. I think before, maybe we had this image of the corpulence, but you know, Justin Trudeau is a perfect example. Obama as well. Even Cameron, I mean, not recently, because we saw his pictures on the beach.
He's let himself go a bit.
He let himself a bit, yeah.
I'm also thinking about this. I'm thinking about what it feels like to be a president, for example, or a politician and be overweight. I saw in my home country, Finland, when Martti Ahtisaari was our president some 20 years ago, he was constantly criticized, in particular by tabloids, about his weight. He was always faced with this issue of, you know, is he drinking too much because he seems to be so fat, and how is he able to climb the stairs to get to the plane because he's so fat, and so forth. And I think in a way that kind of deteriorates your influence as well, your power, because in a way you are not being taken that seriously when there's not that aspect of respect.
Well, you don't want to be a figure of fun, which you could argue the more rotund politician maybe leaves themselves open to. But Henry, one thing I wanted to ask you, we've obviously seen a shift. If you go back, I don't know, certainly mid 20th century here in the UK, the appearance of politicians, whether they were heavyset or not, it would be known within the sort of corridors of power in the Westminster set. But it certainly wasn't speculated upon in the media. And since politics has been made into something of a cult of personality, then I guess this issue about people's appearance or their health or their lifestyles, it becomes fair game. Is this one of those things, as we talk about celebrities in the media saying, well, you know, if you court publicity, then you must be judged by it. Do politicians or the political classes just need to accept now that how they live their lives, including what they look like, how they exercise or don't, how they eat, that is something that is going to be discussed and they'll be judged in the court of public opinion?
Well, I think that the burden of proof should be on the media and on us, the public, actually, because I think that this focus on the candidate's health, the way this is being framed, is actually a convenient justification for smuggling in indulging our fairly invasive curiosity, as you mentioned, about politicians' lifestyles. Now, I think the question that we should ask ourselves, that the media should ask themselves, and that we should ask of the media, is this actually the most pertinent set of questions that we can be asking of our politicians and of the political classes? I mean, you know, on the one hand, perhaps it's inevitable as more information becomes available. You know, I think there's been a lot of discussion on the editorial floor over the course of the week where this has been coming out, where, you know, previously you'd have politicians all over the world, US presidents, JFK with his back problems, you know, politicians with significant health problems, the information simply wasn't available. You know, it wasn't.
But you could control that, whereas now
you control it. Now you can't. Now the question is, now we do have that information available, what meaning should we attribute to it? How much weight should we afford it? You know.
Nice.
Yeah.
Marcus, let me ask you. Now, obviously, this is about the President of the United States. There's a profile, there's a focus on that, a laser focus globally that no other leadership race has. And indeed, no other leader has to contend with the kind of scrutiny that the US president has to contend with in the course of their day-to-day work. In a smaller country, let's say your own, Finland, is there a similar recognition that to be someone with a public profile means you need to open up, and whether that's medical records or how you choose to live your life, the exercise you take or don't take, that is going to be scrutinised? Or is there still a bit more of that, I guess it's that hangover, almost from the Victorian era here in the UK, where these things are just not speculated upon?
It's a bit like that still. There is a certain privacy that politicians get to enjoy in Finland, although Finland learned these lessons quite well after the early 1980s. We had President Kekkonen, who was in power for 4 decades, and in the end he was faced with this problem of so many politicians and the parliament wanted to keep him in power. So he actually stayed there until he was well over 80, and he was having issues. He was basically losing. He was suffering from dementia. And it's been later on revealed that there was some kind of cabinet meeting sometimes when he would be sitting there with his ministers, and everyone would be wondering why, and it was why are we not starting yet? And President Kekkonen would say that we are waiting for President Paasikivi, because he had forgotten that he was actually the president himself. He wasn't in the 1950s anymore.
Now, I mean, that is so clearly after that, having an impact on
exactly. So after that, it was ruled that actually the presidents have to keep updates on their health conditions on a regular basis.
Well, it's a very interesting point that Marcus did, because I think Brazil had a classic example. Our first president after the dictatorship, basically he was elected and he fell ill one day before his inauguration, so he never assumed office. So, and he died 39 days later. And then we had a vice president. That's a classic example, you know, of how health conditions can affect government, literally, because then they might not be able...
In no more profound a way
than that.
One imagines we'll return to this issue of health on the US campaign trail in the remaining weeks of the race. Let's continue though on Midori House with some news from the print industry. Always great to see new titles, and now one of the world's most appreciated and respected newspapers has launched a new one. Die Zeit has launched a magazine aimed at men. It's called Zeit Magazine Man. The magazine will be published twice a year, a 60,000 print run, and is edited by Christoph Armand. Fernando, I'll start with you on this. You can perhaps describe the cover of this new addition to the roster to us, and explain how it fits in, because this is going into the stable of a newspaper, a magazine that we have a lot of time for, some brilliant creative minds behind it. Tell us about this first issue, and maybe speculate as to why now for this magazine and this market.
Absolutely. Well, it's great that Zeit magazines are releasing like a publication only for men. Again, it's how they're investing in print. And of course, I mean, Tony, you present the stack. We do talk about Zeit magazine quite often. It's very cleverly edited. And I have it was launched on the 6th of September last week in Germany, but I'm sure it will come along to the news agents around the world. I mean, it's classic. It's got the classic typeface from Zeit magazine. And there's a beautiful picture of Christopher Waltz on the cover, and I think it's making a joke of Ich bin ein Berliner. It says Ich bin ein anderer, which is I am another. I mean, you guys helped me around with the German, and you know, I trust the quality of this magazine, and you know, they have incredible stories on their first issue. For example, there's a very curious story about Baron Brummer. He's a German. He's 96 years old, and he decided to become a winemaker. So he's not necessarily like a Hollywood actor, but you know, but they decided to do a long profile about him. And it's remarkable that men's magazines, you know, it's a difficult market for magazines around the world, but I think men's magazines is a market that is having a lot of positive news about it.
Well, that's interesting, and obviously, particularly in Germany, it's a robust magazine. We've got other favourites like Heritage Post, we talked about on the stack recently. But Marcus, do you think that the men's magazine market, is it in the same robust health everywhere?
Again, no, it's actually interesting. I'm always particularly delighted when I see new men's magazine being launched, because I used to be so starved for them when I was living in Finland. Finnish print industry tried to launch quite a few titles, but they never quite worked out. And I've been later on wondering and speculating whether there is a strong, how strong the connection is between, say, how many good menswear stores you find in a country and how many that kind of publications they have. Finnish men don't spend too much money on clothes. So in a way, that kind of leads you to assume that maybe they don't want to read about those things from magazines either. And maybe they just don't seem to be paying that much attention to their appearances as, for example, Swedes do or South Europeans do. Fernando, I'd like to hear your thoughts if you think of, say, British men's magazine titles and compare them to, say, what you have in Brazil, for example. How big a difference is there in style?
I think the Brazilian market especially is very similar to the Finnish one, but I think it's changing very rapidly, you know. So every time I go back, there's new magazines coming out. And, you know, you did talked about appearance and fashion. To be honest, that's one of the reasons why men's publications are doing so well. Let's remember that the menswear market, it's the value nowadays is $29 billion and is increasing every year constantly. And of course, because of that, you know, you have more titles as well. I mean, it's remarkable. If you go to any newsagent, I mean, here in London where I live, there's the same amount of magazines that you have for women, you have for men. That was not the case in the past, from what I can remember.
Yeah, I suppose I just want to jump in and make a point about, I mean, I find this kind of new wave of men's magazine coming through to be really interesting. As someone from the United Kingdom, I'm sure Tom will be able to empathise with me in this regard. You know, the connection that I have with men's magazines is in the 90s, you know, we had all the lads mags, Zoo, Nuts, and the idea of a men's magazine was extremely limited, I think, to, you know, women, cars and football. That's what it covered, and it, you know, it kind of helped foment the kind of Britpop, very straight, mainly white, I think, worldview in that regard. And for me, it's been so interesting. For that reason, because I grew up during that time, I always have distanced myself from media aimed exclusively or mainly at men. I've always had quite a squeamish reaction to it because it's been associated with a culture that I don't particularly identify with. But I have seen more and more and more magazines on the shelves being marketed explicitly to men that I find appealing. And I do think that these magazines really are exploring new grounds in terms of masculine identity. You know, they're opening up to more things. And a lot of that has come from gay magazine culture.
I was just going to say the same point, by the way, because I remember when those Finnish titles were launching 15 years ago, and it was awful. It was so stereotypical. It was about cigars and cars and women with rather large breasts in covers. And now all of a sudden we see change clearly towards what gay lifestyle magazines have been representing for a long time. There's grooming tips and tips on, you know, to take care of your health and so forth.
And to be fair, if you're looking for nudity, I think it's better to read a woman's magazine. If you read it nowadays, GQ, Squire, Fantastic Man, I mean, there's literally no women in there almost. It's remarkable. I mean, sometimes one issue or another, but
Fascinating insights. Let's continue. We'll shift from magazines to music. The changing face of the music industry. It has been reported in certain quarters that the iconic Amoeba Music Building on Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles was in danger of being demolished. It's been sold to developers who, some claim, wanted to make room for a big tower with rooftop pool and all of this kind of thing. Claim and counterclaim from the store and the leaseholders and so on. But it is interesting. It's yet more of an example of pressure on commodity space for retail and how record shops in particular look like they might become a thing of the past. Let's talk about the shop a little bit. Fernando, I think I'm right in thinking you've been to to Amoeba Music before a couple of times. There's still some uncertainty about where and when anything might happen. But the very fact that such an iconic institution is that the question could even be asked is a worry.
I was shocked when I read it because, you know, of course, I've been there only two times when I visited LA, the major building in Sunset Boulevard. It was crowded, full of people. So that's why I was surprised, because I don't think record shops will be a thing of the past, you know. I mean, we have a classic example also in the UK where HMV was sold, but then it kind of came back on the high street, you know, of course, on a smaller scale. So I was very much surprised when I read that, because, you know, I think Amoeba, they did something so clever. I believe you've been to the shop as well. You know, they, when you go there, it's a delight, you know. It's not just selling CDs, you know. There's the seller's tips, you know. It's an adventure, it's a journey when you go there. So I was very much shocked, and I wonder if the owners as well just want more profit as well. It's quite a sad news, actually, if this happens.
Now, Marcus, we're used to seeing, you know, even very popular retail spaces coming under pressure, changes of usage. Look, we only need to look around where we're sat here in Marylebone to see office buildings turning residential, shops turning residential, everything basically going residential, because that's where the money is. That's a reality. But nevertheless, there are certain kind of cultural institutions that one would have hoped, at least, would have a longer shelf life, I guess.
I guess it's difficult to say about this specific place. I don't know how much money it has been making and what the financial situation has been over there. I believe that music shops are not going to go. They're not going to vanish totally. I think what we may see happening in the future, what I've been seeing, for example, where I live in East London, is that music shops are finding a different kind of a life. I'm thinking about one of my favorite cafes and music shops, which sells nice coffee, and you have music selection over there, you have some vinyls over there, sometimes they have bands performing over there, and that works really well as a concept. So maybe the direction is that we are leaving behind that kind of massive institutions, and we're going to go somewhere that is more curated, more special, something more on a smaller scale.
Henry, before we move on, just briefly, I mean, what's most important? If you're, you know, you love your music, does the bricks and mortar side of that experience matter to you in the same way that it did even, I don't know, 10 years ago? Or do you think this is just a question of kind of moving with the times?
I find it very difficult to make my mind up as to what the value of these changes are going to be. I kind of came of age and was a teenager right at the tail end of physical music purchasing being kind of mainstream, and I would save up my pocket money, my newspaper round money, and go down to HMV in Swansea Quadrant every weekend.
Yes, please.
And spend my money on CDs. Now, I'm very much aware of and have some appreciation for argument that there is a social function to, you know, going to bricks and mortar retail spaces, even the likes of HMV, which was essentially, you know, the Sainsbury's at the time of music purchasing, and, you know, interacting and looking at the physical discs. On the other hand, I think that the spaces, the kind of spaces that Mark is talking about, which are marketed toward a much more connoisseurial class, niche class, they're much better. First of all, and second of all, you know, you have seen artists responding to the changes in the form that music is being sold in a very creative way. Frank Ocean, I think just last week or the week before, released this two-part album, one of which was a video album which was released you know, on the internet. Beyonce did the same thing a few weeks before that.
The merits or otherwise of which we don't have enough time to debate.
Do we not, Tom?
So we'll move on. This is Midori House. That was Henry Sheridan, Fernando Augusto Pacheco's here, Marcus Hippie too. Up next, we'll be talking the launch of London Fashion Week, and if we've got time, some of the greatest animal heroes of all time.
To celebrate the London Design Festival, Arum Store has teamed up with Monocle to host a 10-day pop-up cafe and shop at the former's Covent Garden location. Stop by to browse the products on show and get your caffeine fix from All Press, served by the Monocle Cafe team. Both brands are extending exclusive offers, including 15% off all Arum Store accessories and special subscription deals from Monocle. From the 14th to the 24th of September at the Arum Store, 110 Drury Lane. For more information, visit arum.co.uk and monocle.com.
This is Midori House on Monocle 24, 1824 here in London. Still with me, Marcus Hippie, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Henry Reese Sheridan. Also joining us, what a wealth of talents we have, Monocle's fashion expert, Jamie Waters, is here. Hello, Jamie.
Hello, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure, as always. Now, let's talk London Fashion Week. Launched today. let's take a step back. Where does this sit in the pantheon of these kinds of events? Where does the event that happens in our own beloved capital sit amongst the rest?
Well, I mean, it's still one of the big events, you know, along with the other fashion capitals in New York, Milan and Paris. I think this particular one, so Spring Summer 17, is coming at a really crucial time because, you know, it's in the wake of Brexit, which was a huge knock to the fashion industry, and something like 90% of British designers were very much against it. So I think it's really important time for us to celebrate British fashion and to be like, you know, this is an important thing for us. In terms of the sort of lineup this year, it's also got huge significance because of Burberry. I think the menswear London shows a few months ago really suffered because there was no Burberry, and they're going to be in the women's shows, and I think that will make a big difference, and they're a big draw card.
Well, let's zero in on that, because I think this is going to be the focus of lots of conversation, not just around this table, but across the city. And it is interesting. We've got various sort of marquee moments, things that make that stand out. Perhaps you can run us through. You know, this is reflecting a lot of the broader debates that are going on within the fashion world at the moment.
Yeah, it's a really interesting show because it's almost like the archetypal modern fashion show, because they're combining their menswear and womenswear collections in one. All the pieces are trans-seasonal, so there's no summer or winter there, or, you know, or for not specific season. Yeah, and also they're following a see now, buy now model. So all the pieces will be available to buy online and in shops as soon as the models walk off the runway. So it's kind of like all these issues that are being debated at the moment, they've decided to put them all in a show.
And do you think, I mean, you know, are we seeing the future? Is this the way everything is going? I'm sure there's lots of traditionalists who'd say, oh, absolutely not. But is there a feeling that this is reflecting, you know, changes that are happening, inexorable trends perhaps?
I think so. I mean, I think it could well be sort of like the blueprint for all future shows. I'm not personally like, you know, I hope that that's not the case, especially the see now, buy now model. You know, I think it kind of takes some of the romance out of the idea of fashion, where you have a 4 month, you see the catwalk show, then there's a 4 month lag before you can buy them. And people, you know, you build up this idea of what do people want, this sort of, you dream about, you know, particular pieces. And I don't know what, Fernando, you have kind of strong thoughts on this as well.
We're chatting about this. I mean, the feeling of anticipation, you know, because now if you see something on the catwalk you can buy straight away. I was talking to Jamie, like, you know, before you see, oh, Hawaiian shirts will be big next summer. Mm-hmm. So, but you have time to get used. You have time to save money if you want to buy that piece. Mm-hmm. But now, and I think for a brand like Burberry, it might work. But what about, you know, small fashion brands? I don't think you can show it on the catwalk and have the products available for sale. So it's not a very good system for everyone, I think.
I think it's also interesting when we're looking at what's going on over here, how Fashion Week like this stays relevant. There's so many different Fashion Weeks around the world. Some of them are more important than others. And at the same time, when we are seeing this globalizing world, when we are seeing more things going digital, I'm wondering, how do they all stay relevant, and how do they even stay alive in this world?
Yeah, time. Well, I mean, I think that's a big problem, and the key is getting these marquee brands to your fashion week, because that's where all the money comes from. And, you know, the fact that London has Burberry means that it can, you know, if it's got big brands like that. But when the menswear week didn't have a big name, and that means there's no buyers, a lot of editors skip it. So there probably isn't room for all these shows, to be honest.
We're going to come back to London Fashion Week, of course, in the days ahead on Monocle 24. But I did want to make a little time to squeeze in some news from nature. Jamie, stay with us. Diego the giant tortoise has bounced into global fame. It's revealed he's had so much sex and fathered so many offspring, he's essentially brought his species back to life. Before Diego managed to repopulate, there were only 2 males and 12 females on the island of Española, the only place the animals are found. Now it's estimated Diego's fathered 800 offspring. I'm sure one of the key questions we all are asking is, what's the soundtrack to some of Diego's activity? I mean, one can only speculate, but maybe it would be something like this. Yeah, let's draw a veil over that. That is legitimate tortoise coitus noise.
We don't know if that was Diego. I'm the producer of this program at the same time. I was wondering whether that is something we should have censored, but I thought it's Friday.
It's Friday evening. Marcus, what about Diego? An animal hero. I know. Where does he? Where would he rank?
I'm quite excited about this story because we are not used to having tortoises as animal heroes. They're normally dogs. I grew up watching Lassie films, and what Diego's been up to has been something on a whole another level. I remember when I was working as a TV host in Finland, I interviewed every year there was a Finnish animal organization, pet organization that chose the hero animals, hero pets of the year. And for example, one year it was this dog that woke up his whole family when there was a fire in the kitchen, and it basically saved everyone over there. Very often these animals seem to be dogs. I'm very surprised by that, but it's a very common story.
Man's best friend.
But there was a fire somewhere and then dogs comes and wakes up everyone.
There are other animals in the mix. One of my favorites still, Wojciech the Syrian bear, saw active service. Used to load the mortars. Pretty good.
He used to load the mortars.
Yeah, because he was much stronger than the regular human males. Animal heroes. Faye, where do you stand on this?
Oh, I think Diego is actually a proper hero because I can relate to that in the sense that, I had turtles in my house, and when I was young. And actually at 4 a.m. they used to wake me up when they were having sex.
So you recognize?
Did it sound like that?
Absolutely. It sounded like that, but much louder and at 4 a.m. So think about it.
I will.
That's kind of a
hero. I reckon I can think of little else.
And I can understand why he has got 800.
Can we play that once again? I just want to hear it again and just think of Fernando at 4 o'clock in the morning waking up to this. Did he ever consider getting just rid of the animals?
No, I thought it was robbers getting inside the house or something, but it was just my turtles having sex.
Do you think we could sell that as a kind of tone that you could download
let's
into your
not.
Phone?
Let's hope that's literally the last time that's ever played. Henry, last word to you. Time is short. You've got another animal hero? You've got 10 seconds.
I just want to make an observation about Diego. Everything seems to be singing his praises. I'm no naturalist, but I do have some concerns about his exploit. He's a father now of nearly 40% of the offspring.
Yeah, it's quite narrow. There's
a narrow gene pool. I'm not sure what the long-term consequences of his promiscuity will be. Only time will tell.
And plenty of it.
Yes, indeed.
He's 100 already.
Indeed.
There we must leave it. Thanks to all my guests. Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Jamie Waters, Marcus Hippie, and Henry Rees Sheridan. Thanks, Marcus, too, for producing and for our studio manager, Toby Hammond, whose responsibility it was to play those appalling noises for you. Monocle's Food and Drink Show, the menu's coming your way at 1900. This show's back at the same time on Monday. Do not miss it.